Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download.
Hey, this is Martin Willis with the Antique Auction Podcast, and I'm in Northampton, New Hampshire. I used to live here, and I'm at Phelps Fullerton's house. And I knew Phelps was an advertising expert and a cataloger, but what I didn't know is that he had an amazing collection, and he just walked me around, and I saw some beautiful, rare, one-of-a-kind pieces here. And also joining us today is Rusty Hammer. Rusty Hammer is a collector. He has a nice name, and he has a restaurant in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and a lot of really nice advertising. And here we go. How you doing, Phelps?
I'm doing good, Marty.
And Rusty, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Now, Rusty's going to pipe in now and then, but he's here more or less to watch. Phelps, it's your day today. So, Phelps, I'm going to ask you, what started you in this this branch of our business?
Well, I guess I'd have to go back about 20 years ago. My wife, Jamie, and I got the antique bug, and we'd go down to Brimfield. Down in Massachusetts, and that's, as you know, an outdoor antique show that runs for a week, and they hold it three times a year. And
didn't we just run into each other there?
We certainly did. Yes. What we would do is we'd kind of hone in on graphic items or utilitarian pieces we could use around the house.
That was the catalyst of
That's kind of how it started, and I think a lot of people that get the antique bug, they'll start out in a general range of different genres, whether it's, you know, pottery or paintings or ceramics, and then through the years, you kind of, you start navigating towards some specific niche, and that's kind of what we did. We got into the old advertising and country store niche of the antique market. And for many years, we had little booth spaces and antique group shops. And we'd take stuff over. We'd sell it out of the shops. And that kind of fed our habit of going out and buying a little bit more expensive items that we wanted to keep ourselves. And I think a lot of people in the antique business, you live with an item for, you know, 5 years or 10 years, you enjoy it, and then it's time for a change. And it's time for something different.
I've done that in marriage, so I know what you're doing. Sorry.
And so, you know, you find, and we've got a relatively small house, which is a blessing in disguise because it prevents you from having too much stuff.
But I should say we're in your barn.
You can never have too much.
Yeah, you haven't seen the whole barn.
Yeah, and, but I did look up on the rafters. Actually, we're not. We're in your barn, but in a beautiful office that you had. That's just, I'll just describe it. There's all kinds of like porcelain and early signs. A lot of, you collect a lot of local things, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, I try to, but Rusty's usually there one step ahead of me.
Yeah. Now, do you guys friendly bid against each other in at an auction or?
Friendly bidding at an auction?
Yeah.
You've been in the business long enough. It doesn't exist.
Oh, I always liked when I see you both walk in the door, sit on opposite sides of the hall.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. We run into each other at auctions.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always fun. You know what we find in this business? It's not what the auctioneer advertises in the sale that you go for. It's what they don't advertise.
Or didn't know to advertise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because once they advertise that you've got a Portsmouth Ale porcelain sign with a big anchor on it in their B or Arts and Antiques ad, everybody's all over it.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, what you're looking for is something that they might have thought was, you know, a little less significant.
You know, a sideline to that is I know an art dealer who made his entire fortune by going through the Newtown Bee and the Antiques Digest and calling every single auction that there was and saying, do you have any paintings or anything that's not listed or anything? And if you do, please send me pictures. This was before eBay and before live, you know, internet.
Right.
And that's how he made his money.
Yeah, eBay certainly has changed the whole landscape of the business.
We'll get into it. I always ask about eBay. So can we just talk a little bit about first, before we go there, Rusty, did you get into this because of your restaurant?
Actually, yes. I found a Frank Jones advertising cardboard piece when we bought the restaurant. And that, you know, started me on it. And about 5 years after that, I went into an antique shop in northern New Hampshire, Woodstock. And the guy had a lot of New Hampshire brewery on it. And that really got me going.
Is that what you collect, brewery on it?
Brewery on it, mostly, yes. And, and Portsmouth.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, tip trays and from all parts of the country.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
mainly it's New Hampshire brewery on it.
Yeah, okay. So, Phelps, why don't we get into a little bit of the history of advertising, collectible advertising. And you just showed me some beautiful graphics. And to me, I think, you know, the days of that that artwork is quite long gone. So can we get into a little bit of the history, what made the graphic advertising popular?
I think what really propelled it was... After the Civil War, you really had a burst in manufacturing, and you had new markets emerging. You had new means of reaching those markets, the Transcontinental Railroad,
right?
The expanding rail routes, and manufacturers began to discover that what they really needed to do was to brand their product. Up until then, you typically go into the general store, and you'd have grain bins, you know, and you'd take a couple of scoops of oats out and or a pound or two of flour, and it was generic. There wasn't any branding with it. And the manufacturers began to discover that if they began to brand their product and call it Aunt Jemima's pancake flour instead of just, you know, pancake flour, or if you had Fairbanks fairy soap or Santa soap, and you created an image to go with that, it really stuck in the consumer's mind.
Sure.
And
that's all memory is. It's a memory image association.
There you go. And when they went back to the general store, they'd look at the shelf and they'd look for the Santa soap or for the Aunt Jemima pancake flour, and they knew that by buying that same brand, they were going to get the same quality as they had before. So there was some guarantee of consistency there. And it wasn't just going back to that same general store. It might be someone living in the Boston area going to New York, to a store in New York, and you walk in and, well, here's my Santa soap. You know, this is the stuff I love. So so you've created branding, and really the advertising... industry sprung up around that. The guy that's credited with coming up with the concept of pre-packaging products in boxes of similar size and weight was a guy by the name of Henry Kroll. He was president of the American Cereal Company.
Now, just did this all this branding and everything, did it start in the U.S., in the United States?
Well... Europe had their own brands. I want to say that the evolution probably followed similar branches. My specific interest is really in American advertising products and signs. So you know, I tend to concentrate on that. But, you know, if you go to... Great Britain, for instance, they probably had branding that emerged about the same time because, you know, now we're now we've got transoceanic communication. We've got instant communication with Europe. And so things that are happening over there that are profitable for American manufacturers, they're going to emerge here pretty quick.
Yes.
So I'm going to say that the timetable was probably on a par, you know, Europe and the United States. But it was Henry Kroll who owned the American Cereal Company, and he wound up buying Quaker Oats, which had gone bankrupt. And he was the one that really introduced the standardization of packaging.
So and the Quaker Oats image that we know today, is that one of the first branding?
One of the first. Really? That was patented 1877, I believe. And that was man in Quaker garb, I think, as it was detailed in the U.S. Patent Office. But it was immediately after he bought the bankrupt Quaker Oats Company that he launched really an all-out advertising blitz. And the Quaker Oats man in the traditional garb appeared everywhere on the sides of buildings. There would be 16 sheet posters, massive posters. And that's something we can get to a little later, was how advertising really got out of control in the United States, in the urban areas, you know, Boston and New York.
Yeah.
They had companies were sending out crews of street urchins in the middle of the night with stacks of their posters, and they would be gluing them to the sides of buildings. And then almost immediately thereafter, there'd be another group of kids with posters under their arms, and they'd be pasting those over the ones that were pasted up a couple hours before.
Like they do in Hollywood with the...
Same thing. Yeah. You know, like circus broadsides and theater broadsides. Mm-hmm. It was the same type of thing. There was one company that specialized in outdoor advertising, and they actually painted an advertisement at Niagara Falls on the rocks. And they did another one up in the White Mountains.
Now you're talking about they did this legally? I mean, was it...
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the time, there wasn't any...
No regulations.
There weren't any regulations about it. Bradbury and Hoftelling, that was the name of the company. And their Hood Sarsaparilla ad campaign appeared on barns, sheds, fences, along railway lines throughout the entire country. But the ad that they painted up at Niagara Falls was for St. Jacob's Oil and Drake's Plantation Bitters. And these were enormous things. And there was a lot of public outrage, you know, about these national treasures being used to advertise a commercial product.
I can't imagine how they could have possibly painted that. You know, with the water... Where is this? On a cliff near the waterfall, but not...
Yeah, it was actually on the rocks.
On the rocks.
Yeah.
Very ambitious.
Yeah, they were at the time, they were the largest national outdoor sign painters of the late 1870s. Hmm. And that's when they started doing this.
Wow.
So that coupled with this saturation in urban areas of, sides of buildings, fences, anything that didn't move, getting covered with an advertising billboard, really prompted city ordinances to start regulating this stuff.
And probably was the birth of billboards, maybe?
Well, billboards were... the actual billboard that you see today is the modern-day version of what would be an 1870s or 1880s building, a gable end wall, or a fence. When you got into urban settings, you typically had these large, tall fences around lots of the properties, and that was open season.
Now, have you ever seen images of some of these signs?
Oh, sure.
I mean, a lot of times... I think it's really cool to see on the side of an old brick building, you can see a faded, nice graphic painted sign.
You can still go through some of the southern cities. Roanoke is a great example. Downtown Roanoke, some of the old brick buildings downtown, you can still see Coca-Cola advertising signs that were painted in the 20s.
Really?
Yeah.
There's still some in Portsmouth.
Down at the end of
Penhallow Street,
Penhallow, and
paint advertising.
Yeah, it's great. So it start now. One thing I wanted to ask you is some of the graphics you showed me today prompted my thought. Now, were there any really high-end noted artists in these earlier advertising pieces?
You know, that's kind of the tragedy. Whether it's, you know, Aunt Jemima Pancake Flour, Buster Brown Shoes, Heinz Pickles, Planters, Campbell's Soup, for the most part, the actual artist went unrecognized.
Mm-hmm.
Out in your neck of the woods on the West Coast, citrus labels... Mm-hmm. Were a whole industry, and there are actually some litho houses that specialized in doing absolutely nothing but creating these paper labels that they would stick on the ends of the orange crates and sure. citrus fruit crates.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just remarkable.
They are.
Miniature pieces of art.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were stone lithographed mm-hmm. from limestone printing plates. The images were very finely stippled. Some of them would be 12 color or 15 color plates. So you needed
a lot of work.
Needed a separate stone for each color.
Yep.
And but none of them carry the artist name that did those.
Now, do any graphics carry the artist name?
Some of them do, and it's not uncommon to find. Particularly when you get into what is referred to as stock advertising, that you have an artist's name attached to it. ASTI, for instance, was a fairly well-known late 19th century artist. And he did a lot of very attractive women profiles with flowing hair.
Mm-hmm.
And stock advertising is where you'd have the salesman who worked for the advertising company traveling about, and he'd be visiting shop owners and mm-hmm. storekeepers, and he'd carry with him a salesman sample book, and it might have 50 or 100 or 200 different images that storekeeper could select from. And then the advertising company would overprint the name of his particular business on top of that stock print.
Now, have you ever seen one of those salesman samples?
I've seen a couple of the salesman sample books.
Really?
And
nice. Yeah.
They made them for a variety of industries. You have salesman sample cigar label books, citrus label books. The trade cards, which were very popular in the 1870s and 80s as a way of advertising local merchants. You'd go into a shop and there'd be a stack on the counter. And these were generally about 3 by 5 inches. And they were stone lithographed, very colorful. And they'd often be these fantasy images of, you know, frogs bicycling down the street, or a goose, you know, pulling a chariot, these kind of fanciful images. And the storekeeper would have the name of his business and his address stamped, overprinted on the card. And it was a national pastime in the days before TV and the internet that people would collect this paper scrap, this ephemera, and they put them into scrapbooks. And as you probably have seen through the years, often when estates come to auction, it's not uncommon that you find
the trade cards.
Some of these scrapbooks with hundreds of these old trade cards.
Yeah.
Another trick the merchant used is often these trade cards would be in a series. There might be 6 different images, frogs on unicycles going through a bunch of different predicaments.
That could happen. Yeah.
Or you might have 12 images in the whole series. And what it did is it got the consumer coming back to the merchant each month when the new cards came in.
Uh-huh. A lot of these stock images, too, were used for different... one might be for beer today, or you might see it tomorrow. The same image would be for soap.
Ah,
the salesman would go around.
Same image.
Yeah,
he wouldn't care who he sold it to as long as someone was buying that image.
Yeah, yeah. How about that? Well,
I had the ASTI image that I mentioned earlier. I've seen that on probably half a dozen different products.
Mm.
Everything from a Rusaller brewing company out in California to Goodrich Tires.
Yeah. So let's just quickly go through the different types of advertising that people collect. There's the die cuts, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you've got initially it was the inexpensive paper products that the merchants went with because they got a lot of bang for the buck.
Yeah.
Calendars.
Oh, yes.
Calendars really initially captured the market because now with the stone lithography, they were able to buy an advertising item that the consumer would take home and they put on the wall for 12 months. Hmm. And it would advertise the merchant or that particular brand product for 12 months.
It's still a strong use.
It's still a strong use today. Sure.
Yeah.
Up until the late 1880s, most of these were relatively small. They might be on the order of 6 by 9 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, they'd just be one 6 by 9 inch square piece of cardboard mm-hmm. with all the months of the year stamped on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be a grommet, a metal grommet at the top for hanging it. Once you got into the 1890s, the techniques of lithography changed, and the industry started switching over from these very large and heavy, cumbersome limestone blocks.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to appreciate is that the smallest of these stones might be 6 by 6 by 4 inches thick,
mm-hmm.
and traditionally they'd be pieces of Bavarian limestone that was found to be the most effective printing plate for the process that was being used. Lithography is basically relies upon the scientific principle that oil and water don't mix. And it's planographic printing. In other words, it's a completely flat surface. It's not etched like mm-hmm. a metal plate that has a relief.
Mm-hmm.
And through a chemical process, the lithographic company would sensitize these plates and they'd ink them up with oily inks. And basically, you would have to create a reverse image of mm-hmm. what you wanted printed on paper,
mm-hmm.
on your limestone plate. So all of your lettering had to be done in reverse. It was really incredibly time-consuming.
Hmm.
For each color, you needed to use a new stone.
Hmm.
Praying in Boston, a lot of immigrants came over from Europe because stateside they could make 10 times the money they were making in Europe. And some of the finest artisans came over to the print shops here in the U.S. Prangs had some of the best. And most of these were German immigrants. And some of Prang's lithographs used up to 25 different colors.
Wow.
And a lot of those colors were kind of printer's trade secrets.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them would be metallic powders, bronze powders, where they could print a metallic gold color. Fascinating process that they went through. But what was happening by the 1890s is the industry had discovered that they could switch over to using much thinner zinc plates. And,
right.
mm-hmm. and the zinc actually acted, in essence, a lot like the limestone surface. And they discovered that they could start making these plates really thin.
Did they put these on a drum eventually, or are they all flat pressed?
Right up until probably the 1880s, most of this stuff was all done on a flatbed press.
Mm-hmm.
They had steam-powered flatbed presses
mm-hmm.
to be able to print much faster than the old process of loading in the sheets of paper by hand.
Mm.
But once you got into 1890s, you started to see the process where they would use, they call them rubber blankets. Mm-hmm. And the rubber blanket would be wrapped around a roller. Mm-hmm. And that was really the introduction of offset printing, mm-hmm. where they would use two rubber rollers. I call them rollers. They'd be rubber blankets wrapped around the roller. And one roller would get inked. It would ink your flat plate. And then it would transfer that image to another rubber roller. And that was the rubber roller that would be used to print your piece.
So that would be correcting the reverse?
Depends upon what medium you're using.
Mm-hmm.
If you're printing on paper, it was a relatively easy process because the roller and the paper were very compatible. When you get into a situation where you're printing on tin, it becomes a lot more complicated. The limestone blocks and the zinc plates really weren't suitable for printing on a tin surface.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And they were too...
Excuse me. When I think about tin litho, I always think of it being grainy, sort of. Is that because of the printing process?
Is being grained?
Grainy compared to other lithographs. You know, like you can see the little dots fairly easy.
It all depends upon the tooth of the plate.
Hmm.
Some of them were very finely polished so that you could use a stippling process. Mm-hmm. And that was basically a wax crayon.
Hmm.
That was filed to a very fine point. And it was that grease pencil or that grease crayon that was used to create those tiny little dots.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and that would be done on a very finely ground plate.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the theater posters produced by Jules Charest, or you get some of these other artists who were using... large canvases for their advertising signs. They wanted the tooth of the stone. That added to the texture of the print.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't grind the stones as smooth.
Hmm.
They wanted to have that tooth.
Wow. Now, I know you're just looking something up real quickly, but I wanted to, for the collectors, I wanted to start talking about things like what is a really good type of piece to look for. If you're in a lot of people that will be listening would either have never collected or be a novice collector. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what sort of things are something to look for, and also how careful you have to be of reproductions.
You know, I think if you're starting out and you're collecting this stuff, collect what you like.
Collect what you like.
You know,
because you're going to live with it.
Yeah, live with it. Enjoy it. That's what it's all about. If you're a dealer and your sole end game is to, you know, buy something to flip and make money on, it's a whole different story.
Yeah.
But for someone who wants to start a collection, you know, focus on something that you like, whether it's graphics, whether it's something regional. Mm-hmm. From the town or geographic area that you live in.
Like Phelps said before, too, once you've had it 4 or 5 years, your taste may change, but if it's something you like, chances are someone else is going to like it also.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on the more common things, that's where you really have to be careful about what's a reproduction. Is that, I mean, something from a town, say, we're talking about Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Portsmouth, New Hampshire items, for instance, you really don't have to worry about reproductions or fakes on that, or do you? Depends on how popular it is.
Yeah, you know, there's especially these days because
eBay has everything on it.
Yeah, people have gotten so good at reproducing just about anything, and it doesn't matter whether it's printed advertising or ceramics.
Yeah,
you know, across the spectrum. I consult for an auction house up in. Fairfield, Maine.
Jim Julius,
yes. And I've been with him for about 9 years. We do two auctions a year that are specifically devoted to antique advertising and country store items.
Right. Yeah.
And we also, another specialist come up and they do toys and dolls that are included in that.
Always at the same time, right?
Yeah. And we have, there's a fall sale and then there's a spring or early summer sale. And lately, some of these pieces you find that you really have to blacklight them.
Really?
Yeah.
And even you, after all these years, have to really look at
stuff. Yeah, this stuff has gotten so good. And you can take a porcelain sign and you can take a heavy object and bang it up and chip a half a dozen pieces off it. And there are people that can repair that sign so that you can't tell there was ever any damage done to it. Mm-hmm. The airbrush work is so good on tin signs that we've had pieces come in that have been 50% airbrushed, but you wouldn't know it standing 2 feet from it, looking at it on a wall. It looks like it came right out of the factory.
Now, with advertising, is it like every aspect of this business, you know, condition is so important?
Yeah, except when you start getting into extremely rare items.
Sure.
And those that are very desirably sought after, early Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. There's a large number of collectors that enjoy collecting early soft drink advertising. Mm-hmm. And an early Coca-Cola calendar, for instance, if you came across an old scrap trade card album and you opened up one page and here's your 1898 Coca-Cola calendar in excellent condition, mm-hmm. That's going to go out at auction at about $25,000.
Boy.
But if that same calendar was, you know, maybe it had been, a corner had been torn off, maybe one of the kids had used it for, crayon coloring at one time, mm-hmm. That same calendar might bring $500.
Sure.
So in that respect, condition is critical.
Mm-hmm. While we're on this subject of money, do you know what the most expensive original advertising graphic has sold for as far as an auction record goes?
I'm going to say probably the Campbell's tin soup sign.
Was that Richard Oliver's? Or is that, I know he sold one for $99,000, something like that?
Yeah, Richard sold his, I think it was $93,500. Mm-hmm. It was in that ballpark. And I can't recall whether that was a buyer's premium added to that or not. That was certainly one of the highest, if not the highest. You have to remember, a lot of these rare pieces change hands privately.
Sure.
Not necessarily at auction.
Now, are there trade shows and things like that? Trade shows that these sell at?
You're going to find that there's an Antique Advertising Association of America, mm-hmm. a 4A group that have annual gatherings, and they'll have an auction, and they'll have items for sale amongst the members of that association.
And the individual types, like the beer, have trade shows.
They do.
Gasoline collectors, mm-hmm. They all have their own little shows everywhere, all across the country.
Uh-huh. Rusty, I would consider you kind of along the lines of a higher-end collector of what you collect. Do you have people that contact you and say, look, I just found this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I've bought a lot of things from Phelps.
Phelps, your eyes out there.
Yeah. It's always good to have someone looking in the same thing.
Sure.
And again, with the clubs, you get to know so many people. You know, there's probably three or four different beer clubs that I belong to. And, from all over the country, people, once they know what you're looking for, and if mm-hmm. you're high-end, it kind of gets out there a little easier anyways.
Yeah, a little side story here about Rusty. I was in a house in a town called Kittery Point out here, and I was just about ready to leave the house, and I looked up in the attic, and up on the inside of the attic was a balloon advertising piece. Frank Jones Brewery in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I very carefully pulled the tax out of it and put it in my auction. And you ended up with that piece.
I eventually. Did.
But you didn't buy it at my auction.
I didn't buy it at your auction. I bought it at another auction.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what you paid for that?
Actually, I stole it.
You did?
Yeah, I think I paid $300 for it.
I sold it for $1,300.
Yeah, it may have not been the same one.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm not sure if it was exactly, but yeah. I stole mine.
Wow.
I know today it's worth, more than the $1,300 probably.
Yeah, yeah. Again, condition.
Yes, condition. I've only seen a couple of those.
Yeah.
And, you have one. I think I have one, and I think I've seen one other one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a very rare image.
Yeah.
Back to your question earlier, Marty, about what people should be looking for other than what they enjoy collecting. Subject matter is important to the value of a piece as well. Generally speaking, items that tend to bring stronger prices when the subject matter includes Old West scenes, cowboys, Indians... Mm-hmm. Saloon images are very popular. Attractive women.
Yeah.
Partially clad women.
That's always popular.
Yeah. Did I mention partially clad women? strong graphics and colors. The Campbell Soup sign is a classic. It's almost an iconic piece of...
Now, if I remember right, isn't that like an American flag with a Campbell Soup
something? And that was... that sign... It has Campbell's soup cans arranged so that it appears to look like the American flag.
Right, yeah.
That was produced out of Coshocton, Ohio. And there was such a public outcry again about using the American flag to promote your commercial product that Campbell's quickly recalled the sign.
Oh, that's right.
The sign was printed between 1900 and 1901 by Henry Beach's Standard Advertising Company. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get all the signs back to destroy them. There were still a number of them that remained out there.
Mm-hmm.
And through the years, I've probably seen a half a dozen of them surface.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all brought pretty strong money.
Now, one thing you showed me early in one of your graphic advertising pieces was... some type of children's medicine, and you said it had morphine in it?
So yeah.
Is that type of thing collectible?
Yeah, it is. Before the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, patent
is that
medicines,
the beginning of the FDA?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Patent medicines were extremely popular. Mm-hmm. And, the claims were outrageous. They claim they would cure everything from debility... To
dropsy. Don't forget dropsy.
Dropsy, broken bones, just about anything.
A lot of beer advertised for family use.
Yeah,
a lot of little kids drank beer.
Coca-Cola's claimed that
cocaine.
Only that it cured headaches, but it relieved exhaustion, and it was a brain tonic. Once that the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act came into play. A lot of those companies retracted those outrageous claims. Although in the case of Coca-Cola, their initial recipe did in fact contain cocaine.
Right, yeah.
And it was pretty popular.
My great-grandmother loved it.
It actually contained a slight trace of cocaine right up through the teens. And that was based upon the trademark. They were afraid that if they took out all the cocaine, that they would lose the rights to use the word Coca-Cola.
How about that?
The coca leaf is still being used as a flavoring ingredient in it, but there is absolutely no alkaloid, active ingredient in it. The patent medicines, for the most part, they combined alcohol with a narcotic.
Yeah.
And whether it was morphine or opium
or cocaine,
a bear marketed heroin over the counter as a cough suppressant from 1898 to 1910.
But yeah. if you coughed, you just wouldn't care about it, right?
I think that might work.
Yeah.
Ayers cherry pectoral. Now there's there was a company with a brand name that distributed trade cards and posters that often featured young children, and it was hawked as curing colds, coughs, and all diseases. But depending upon what year you bought it, either contained morphine or heroin. Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup for children. Boy, that stuff sounds great. That contained 1 grain of morphine per fluid ounce.
This is good stuff.
Just go to sleep real
quick. That'll keep the rugrats quiet for a while.
Start young.
And even up until 1914, when the U.S. passed the Harrison Act, cocaine was actually sold over the counter. One of the most outrageous stories that you'll read if you go online is Pope Leo XIII endorsing a wine tonic that was called Vin Mariana. And in this company's advertising, they actually had the Pope who was promoting this stuff, which was loaded with cocaine at the time.
Wow.
And he went as far as awarding the owner of the company, Angelo Mariana, the producer, with a Vatican gold medal. So you know that stuff was pretty effective. But yeah, right up until really 1914 Harrison Act, before they started, you know, getting serious about taking the narcotics.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, I know this is a little off track here, but I wonder how many people became so addicted to this stuff once it changed. You know, there was a lot of trouble.
There is some interesting literature out there that traces the popularity of certain patent medicines. And also, you can find a lot of literature online as to what the ingredients were. Because once that Pure Food and Drug Act came into being, manufacturers now had to indicate on the packaging what was in the product.
Now, do you think, skipping around a little bit here, today's world of advertising, do you think there's, can you name in, or think of any examples of someone that really cares about the graphic part of that, or is that, did that all just fade away in the 50s? When did it start really changing?
Television. I think did a lot to it.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, advertising is a reflection of what's going on in society as a whole. You know, if you've got your Victorian advertising was influenced by Victorian activities of the day, you know, women fashionably attired in a lot of these early advertisements, or bar advertisements and brewery advertisements, and as times changed, as you went from the Art Nouveau period into, say, the Art Deco period, you had advertising that began to change to reflect those artistic styles that were popular of the day. You know, when you start to put men into outer space, you start getting some cereal box advertising that's full of astronauts and, you know, people walking on the moon.
Yeah. Now, one thing, you know, this movement of advertising started post-Civil War. Transcontinental Railroad was 1867, just after that. So when, why didn't they use more photography? Photography was real popular. Why didn't they use photography in advertising?
Some they did. And actually,
what's that?
The Kodak had a picture of people taking pictures, I think, was one of their big ads, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think the biggest contribution photography made to the advertising world was at the turn of the century when the lithographers discovered that they could produce photomechanical halftone reproductions of images, and using photographic methods, they could take an original piece of artwork and they could use screens, color screens,
mm-hmm.
to create three or four different printing plates. And by doing that, it virtually made the lithographer obsolete. You now had photomechanical offset color printing.
Hmm.
And now these presses could produce 100,000 images per hour. It was just phenomenal. The cost in producing that image dropped phenomenally.
Sure.
It made it so inexpensive that now manufacturers are going to magazines for a lot of their advertising because it was really cheap.
Sure.
And they could have color ads in the magazines.
Yeah.
So I think the largest contribution that photography made came about with the advent of the photomechanical offset color printing, the color separations.
Now we're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you also for the novice collector where they could collect in confidence that they're not collecting a reproduction.
First off, if you don't know what you're buying, you might want to think twice before pulling the trigger on buying it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're,
in other words, if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
Yeah, you certainly need to get a basic fundamental understanding of, I think, the printing process. That alone tells you a lot about whether an item's original or reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
As I just mentioned, the photomechanical offset color printing, that creates an image that, when you put a magnifying glass to it, has rows of very fine linear dots.
Mm-hmm.
The early stone litho methods, you've got a random pattern of much larger dots, or it's got a crayon texture that reflects the tooth of the printing plate, the stone or the zinc plate. So, I mean, even my wife and I through the years have bought reproductions that have looked so good, it wasn't until later when we actually, you know, sat down, we realized, you know, in fact, we had bought a reproduction. A classic example, had a potential consigner walk into the gallery one day, and he had a De La Valle tin sign, and De La Valle made cream separators.
Mm-hmm.
That was their product that was used on every farm across the country.
Don't you have a sign, a sand sign? Did I see that?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
And the De La Valle company made these rather large tin embossed signs, and some not embossed, and they were provided to the dealers, and they were framed in these rather ornate, gessoed, heavy gilt frames. But people later on made reproductions of them because they were so popular.
Hmm.
And some of the reproductions will have stains from the original that are reproduced in the later tin reproduction. You know, pretty obvious. When you put a loop to it, that halftone pattern jumps right out at you.
Right. So would you suggest someone buying from a reputable dealer?
No question.
Yeah.
Buy from somebody who is has been around for a while, somebody that you might know, somebody that's willing to take an item back if it doesn't prove to be right.
That's always a good...
caveat emptor.
Mm-hmm.
At auction, you've got to... you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Very few auctioneers... these days are going to warranty everything that they sell.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, as shown, as seen.
It's in most terms of sale.
Well, it is. Mm-hmm. And you can't honestly expect an auctioneer to, you know, fully know the provenance of every single item that they get in at an auction. It's just not reasonable.
Until you get to know your items, it's always good to buy stuff from someone who has like items. In other words, if someone has a tin lithograph sign and they sell furniture, well, they might not know.
Hmm.
Where if someone had half a dozen signs of different kinds of advertising, they might be more knowledgeable, and you know, chances are it's right.
Yeah, yeah. Now, are there any? We have to wrap this up. Are there any websites you would suggest for someone to get information off that you can think of off the top of your head?
Yeah, I think what they might want to try is the Antique Advertising Association of America, and that's abbreviated as 4A. That's a good website.
So it would be AAAA.
That's correct. Right.
All right.
That'll give you some information. You're also going to find, depending upon where you live, some of the larger public libraries house collections, particularly if you're out on the West Coast. Pomona Public Library has a phenomenal collection of citrus labels. And a lot of these collections have been donated to the libraries. Riverside, California has a phenomenal collection. The New York Public Library has a fabulous collection of early antique advertising posters. Some of this you can access online. Other libraries, you actually have to go there to view the images. They're in special collection departments, and you need to get sign-in access.
I'm going to tell you a quick story. I was at an auction in California, in Oakland, and there was a box of paper wrapped up into these graphic labels, citrus labels, and they were like brand new. And I know they were all original, and I couldn't convince anyone that they were original, but they were, because they were in such perfect mint condition. But they were all wrapped in bundles of rope and paper, and there had to be thousands and thousands of them.
And what happened, those paper labels were produced almost right up until World War II.
They're very thin, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, all the labels, whether they were made in 1870s or 1930s and 40s, they're all essentially the same weight paper and the same size. Mm-hmm. You know, the orange label, so it really hasn't changed, and the lemon. But what happened, the industry, the packing industry, switched over almost overnight to the use of cardboard boxes from the wooden crates. And now they can print directly onto the cardboard box.
Yeah.
So piles of those unused old labels sat in the packing plants.
Sure.
I myself remember years ago going through one in Florida that had been abandoned. And walking through this building, there were barrels full of bundles of these old labels. And I didn't think a lot of it at the time, particularly later when one of the locals told me that those old packing plants happened to be the favorite habitat for coral snakes and some other deadly reptile.
Yeah.
And he said, nah, you don't want to be going in there without some boots.
Did they reproduce those citrus labels?
I think they did, didn't they?
You can go online right now buy reproductions. Yeah. But, yeah, you've got to be really careful. Gordon McClelland and Jay Lask wrote the definitive book on early citrus labels.
Good information.
If you're going to... If you're going to get interested in that niche, you got to pick up their book.
Sure.
And they also explain the lithography methods at the end of the book, and they show you the difference between early stone lithos, the metal plate lithos, and then the photomechanical offset printed label. So that's a great reference.
Really? Well, I had a whole bunch of other questions to ask you, but we went a little too long. So I guess this is going to be about it today. Thank you so much. This is Martin Willis with Phelps Fullerton and Rusty Hammer, and we're signing off. Perfect.
Whew.
Today's show was brought to you by Audible. Visit audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast for your free audiobook download. There are over 75,000 titles to choose from. We thank you for listening today, and we hope you enjoyed the show.